This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. If you are looking for that ultimate shortcut to being thoroughly and surprisingly well-informed, skipping the noise and getting straight to the core insights buried in the source material, you are in the right place. Today, we are undertaking a deep dive into the life and career of a true Hollywood anomaly, an actress who built her career not by maintaining a flawless image, but by, well, actively destroying it.
Right. Becoming a master transformer, an A-list action star, a powerful producer, and on top of all that, a global activist.
We are unpacking the extraordinary and often traumatic journey of Charlize Theron.
And the goal today is to really synthesize the massive volume of sources detailing her path. I mean, we are looking at a performer who holds dual South African and U.S. citizenship.
Which is pretty unusual in itself.
It is. And she secures an Academy Award, a Golden Globe, and is consistently ranked among the world's highest paid actresses.
It's a career of just exceptional longevity.
It is. And that all culminated in her being named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People back in 2016.
That influence, that status, it's all deeply anchored in a story that feels almost mythological. We're going beyond just the accolades here.
Oh, way beyond.
We're talking about a narrative that involves surviving childhood trauma, the near collapse of her lifelong ambition, and, you know, literal desperation that led to stealing bread just to eat in Los Angeles.
And then that completely accidental discovery at a bank that just redirected her entire fate.
Exactly. This isn't just a biography. It's a profound study in resilience and, I think, strategic career control.
To truly grasp the intensity and the resilience that really defines her approach to her work and her activism, we have to begin in Benoni, South Africa.
Right.
Charlize Theron was born there in the Transvaal province on August 7, 1975.
Okay, so she was the only child of Gerda and Charles Theron.
Mm-hmm, and they were involved in road construction.
And these origins are absolutely critical because they inform her, you know, her unique cultural identity. She comes from an Afrikaner family.
Yes. For those who are maybe less familiar with South African history, the Afrikaners are primarily descendants of the 17th century Dutch settlers.
Along with the German and French immigrants, right? The early Huguenots.
Exactly. So this isn't just a geographical background. It's a really distinct cultural lineage.
And you can see that reflected in her family history. There's a specific, really surprising detail from the sources.
The Daniel Theron connection.
Yes. Her great-granduncle was Daniel Theron, who was a famous Boer military leader during the Second Boer War.
That history, that deep root in the specific, often turbulent history of South Africa, it's really part of her DNA.
And while she is completely fluent in English today, her first language was actually Afrikaans.
Which means she entered the global stage carrying this very distinct cultural lens.
She grew up on her parents' farm near Johannesburg, which, as you said, sounds idyllic, but her early life was anything but smooth.
No, not at all. We find evidence of some intense early physical struggles. Our sources confirm she suffered frequent bouts of jaundice all throughout her childhood.
But the most striking detail, I think, the one that speaks volumes about her tenacity, is the issue with her teeth.
Oh, that's the detail that really sticks with you.
It is. Due to the strong antibiotics she was given as a child, her upper incisor milk teeth rotted.
And they had to be surgically removed.
Yeah.
And her permanent teeth, which most kids get pretty early on, they didn't actually grow in until she was about 10 years old.
Can you just imagine the social difficulty that presents? Being a child, an only child, missing your front teeth for several crucial developmental years.
Well, she's admitted herself that this physical distinction likely contributed to her feeling of being profoundly different, or as she put it, not fitting in at Putfontein Primary School.
And the whole sociopolitical environment demanded this kind of self-reliance. She grew up under the sanctions era in South Africa.
Right.
And she often reflected that she and her mother had to be creative because they had, in her words, no Game Boys, no computers.
Very limited access to any external entertainment.
So she was forced into self-entertainment and this fierce independence from a very young age. These are qualities that would later just define her career.
And at age 13, recognizing the need for better artistic exposure, she was sent to boarding school.
To attend the National School of the Arts in Johannesburg.
Right. But that early life of emotional and physical hardship, it reached this just unspeakable climax that provides the central anchor for the intense resilience we see later in her life.
On the night of June 21st, 1991, everything changed.
Everything.
It's a foundational tragedy, and we should approach it with, you know, careful respect for the trauma involved. Theron's father, Charles, was a severe alcoholic.
And on that night, he came home drunk and threatened both Charlize, who's just 15 at the time, and her mother, Gerda.
And he physically attacked Gerda and then fired a gun at both of them.
It's just horrifying. And in a desperate, immediate act of self-preservation, Theron's mother retrieved her own handgun, she returned fire,
yeah,
and she killed him.
And the shooting was investigated thoroughly by the authorities.
Mm-hmm. And it was legally ruled justifiable homicide or self-defense. Her mother faced no criminal charges.
The psychological weight of surviving an event like that is just monumental. To witness your father's violence and then your mother's swift, lethal defense, it must imprint this undeniable sense of reality and vulnerability and sheer grit.
And that's where the analysis becomes so crucial for understanding her career trajectory. This formative trauma surviving violence, witnessing her mother's desperate resilience, it provided her with this unparalleled reservoir of emotional truth.
So when we look at her later career choices, particularly those gritty, unglamorous roles.
The ones involving troubled or resilient women facing male violence, yes.
Monster, North Country, Bombshell. This context is just foundational. It stops being a creative choice and it starts looking like, well, a compulsion to explore the reality of human brokenness and survival.
Absolutely. And it explains her intense commitment to activism against violence toward women and girls. It's not just a political stance adopted by a celebrity.
No, it's a mission.
It's a mission driven by the most profound personal experience imaginable. And you couple that with growing up during the instability of apartheid. And this history taught her that the world is inherently unfair and requires a fight for justice.
Which she would later translate into global advocacy work.
Exactly. This level of intensity, rooted in her South African past, it definitely set the stage for the massive risks she took to pivot her life toward the arts.
But that initial passion after the trauma, it wasn't cinema at all, it was dance.
Not at all. She genuinely saw herself as a ballerina, and trained in New York City at the prestigious Joffrey Ballet School.
A goal she'd had since moving to the National School of the Arts back in South Africa.
Her single focus was the corps de ballet. And this is where we see the first major professional failure that forced her to pivot her entire identity.
The knee injury.
A severe knee injury that completely derailed her path to professional ballet. She recalled that period as throwing her into a major depression.
I mean, her life plan, the singular focus she had developed to escape her past, was just abruptly taken away.
It's brutal. But her ability to rapidly adapt is just astonishing. She leveraged the training she'd received back in South Africa and used her natural physical presence to pivot into modeling.
At just 16, she won a one-year modeling contract competition in Salerno, Italy.
And that contract was her ticket out. She spent the next year modeling across Europe, living with her mother in Milan, before they moved to the U.S.
And they were bouncing between New York and Miami.
Right, but this wasn't a glamorous, sustained career. It was a stepping stone, a means to save money and gain mobility.
And the true inflection point came in 1994. Armed with a one-way ticket bought by her mother, she moved to Los Angeles.
A hugely audacious move. She decided to enter the film industry as a non-U.S. citizen with an uncertain background and almost no professional network.
Audacious is the right word, but the early reality was just brutal.
So brutal. She arrived with what our sources confirm was a meager budget of just $300 from her mother.
And she was living in a motel, the absolute definition of paycheck to paycheck survival.
The images of that time are so stark. She has spoken publicly about the sheer desperation of that period, recounting the experience of literally stealing bread from a basket in a restaurant just to stave off hunger.
That's not a narrative of a struggling starlet. That's genuine hand-to-mouth poverty.
Which brings us to perhaps the most famous, or maybe infamous, origin story in modern Hollywood.
The bank teller discovery.
Exactly. It perfectly illustrates how opportunity can spring from pure desperation.
Okay, so let's unpack this. She was at a Hollywood Boulevard bank trying to cash a check.
A few checks, but primarily one sent from her mother. But it was rejected because it was out of state,
right,
and she hadn't yet secured U.S. citizenship.
So the frustration just boils over. She has next to nothing, and this check represents her survival.
So she starts arguing, pleading, and eventually yelling at the teller right there in the lobby.
Drawing everyone's attention. She was putting on a very public scene of financial distress.
And fate intervenes in the form of the next customer in line. John Crosby, a powerful talent.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. Let's start 2026 with a hard truth. There's no perfect time to build the future you secretly dream of, and there's no time to waste. With support from a Talkspace therapist, you can make this the year you bravely go out and grab what you need from life, whether that's outer rewards or inner peace. Just go to Talkspace.com to be matched with a licensed online therapist. You can start messaging with your therapist right away and schedule live virtual sessions over video, audio, or chat. Your Talkspace therapist can help you create personalized strategies for making the changes and achieving the goals most important to you. Talkspace accepts most insurance with an average copay of $15, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com and save $80 with code SPACE80. That's SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Agent.
Right. Crosby intervenes, reportedly stepping forward, calming the situation, and paying the teller the money to cash the check himself.
And then he hands this angry, beautiful, desperate woman his business card, and that leads her directly to acting school.
It is the ultimate Hollywood fairy tale, except the fairy godmother was a powerful agent intervening in a tantrum over an out-of-state check.
It just confirms that industry maxim, talent and charisma, even when it's expressed as anger, are instantly recognizable.
Her entry into film was immediate, but small.
Very small. A non-speaking role in Children of the Corn III, Urban Harvest, in 1995.
Her first speaking role came quickly after, portraying the hit woman Helga Svelgen in 2 Days in the Valley.
And that role immediately got attention. She was striking, she was physical, she had that memorable fight scene with Terry Hatcher's character.
So she was instantly branded as the beautiful blonde bombshell.
And that quick branding came with the immediate risk of typecasting, a challenge she actively and strategically fought from the very start.
She recognized that the industry wanted her to just play the same part over and over.
Beautiful, often villainous or objectified. She resisted that pressure, noting that people were urging her to just hit while the iron's hot.
But she instinctively understood that longevity meant artistic variance. Her physical appearance could be an asset, but it couldn't be her only tool.
And this decision to branch out, to actively seek roles that subverted her beauty, became the defining professional move of her life.
That strategic resistance was likely solidified through her close relationship with her agent and mentor, J.J. Harris.
Right. Harris was the one instrumental in encouraging her to look beyond just acting and to venture into production early on to secure agency over her own roles.
The first major breakout role that transcended her initial typecasting came in 1997 with The Devil's Advocate.
Mm-hmm. Starring opposite Keanu Reeves and Al Pacino.
Huh.
Her performance there demonstrated an emotional depth the industry hadn't really seen from her yet.
She followed that with the family adventure film Mighty Joe Young in 98, which was a box office flop.
Showing the volatility of the industry, yeah.
But she quickly rebounded with the commercial success of the Cider House Rules in 1999.
And by the late 90s, she was inescapable. She landed the cover of Vanity Fair in January 1999, which dubbed her the White Hot Venus.
And she also faced her first major media controversy when Playboy published unauthorized photos taken years earlier when she was an unknown model.
She sued, though unsuccessfully, which I think indicates her early commitment to controlling her public image and narrative, even if it meant fighting a losing legal battle.
The early 2000s, before her massive transformation, saw this period that was commercially, well, patchy.
Very patchy. Reindeer Games, The Yards, The Legend of Bagger Vance, Sweet November.
The Curse of the Jade Scorpion, Trapped. This period could have derailed a lesser star.
But this patchy phase was actually crucial for her artistic foundation. She developed what she called a love affair with directors she admired.
Right. She openly prioritized artistic collaboration over commercial viability.
For instance, she did Reindeer Games, which she herself called not a good movie, solely because she wanted to work with the esteemed director John Frankenheimer.
So she was consciously investing in her artistic capital. She was signaling to the industry, I am here for the craft and the caliber of the collaborator, not just the box office gross.
Exactly. This was the strategic groundwork that allowed her to make the truly shocking pivot that came next. She established her reputation not just as a beautiful commodity, but as a serious actress seeking challenging projects.
The phase transition began in 2003, and before she undertook the role that would define her, she secured a major mainstream hit, which gave her the necessary commercial leverage.
The Italian Job.
The Italian Job. That was a critical film for her career's business trajectory.
Absolutely. Playing the safe and vault technician in that high-octane heist film was a resounding commercial success, grossing $176 million worldwide.
It proved she could carry a blockbuster.
And perform alongside major ensemble casts. This financial success gave her the freedom to take the artistic leap that followed.
And what a leap it was. The immediate follow-up was the film that fundamentally redefined her professional identity and proved her capacity for total immersion, Monster.
For this 2003 film, she committed fully to portraying Aileen Wuornos, the real-life serial killer executed in Florida the year before.
And the transformation wasn't just aesthetic, which was huge, involving weight gain and facial prosthetics. It was psychological.
She was just unrecognizable. She didn't just transform her body, she transformed her entire presence.
And the film critic Roger Ebert, he immediately recognized the depth of that commitment. He famously declared it one of the greatest performances in the history of the cinema.
I mean, that's not mere praise, that's historical positioning.
And the industry swiftly confirmed that assessment. She won the Silver Bear at Berlin, the Golden Globe, the Screen Actors Guild Award.
And then, in 2004, the Academy Award for Best Actress.
And this moment was historic not only for her career, but for her homeland. She became the first South African ever to win an acting Oscar.
Her critical success instantly converted into unprecedented financial clout. The sources confirmed that by 2006, she jumped onto the Hollywood Reporter's list of highest paid actresses.
Ranking seventh and commanding up to $10 million per film.
She had successfully leveraged artistic risk into commercial domination, becoming one of the rare actors who could operate on both prestige and commercial fronts.
And she did not slow down. She immediately diversified, demonstrating her range across different media.
She earned both Golden Globes and Emmy nominations for her subtle portrayal of Swedish actress Britt Ekland in the 2004 HBO film The Life and Death of Peter Sellers.
And she even injected herself into high-level comedy, appearing in the third season of Arrested Development.
As Rita, yes, the mentally challenged love interest of Michael Bluth.
That move showed such a lack of professional vanity, opting for a challenging comedic character role in a critically beloved show.
Although she had that massive hit with The Italian Job, she still had misfires. Her 2005 sci-fi thriller Aeon Flux was financially unsuccessful.
Right, but it's worth noting her commitment was still evident. She won a Spike Video Game Award for the voiceover work. So even in failure, she found an artistic accolade.
Then came 2005, which delivered the second confirmation of her transformative power, North Country.
Mm-hmm. She played a single mother and iron mine worker dealing with widespread sexual harassment.
David Rooney of Variety made a very pointed observation about this performance. He stated that it was, in many ways, more accomplished than her work in Monster.
More accomplished? Why?
Well, because Monster was so reliant on that total physical transformation, while North Country demanded a more sustained, authentic, working-class grit, anchoring the film in the tradition of classic American social dramas.
Like Norma Rae or Silkwood.
Exactly. Roger Ebert amplified that sentiment, calling her an actress who has the beauty of a fashion model, but has found resources within herself for these powerful roles about unglamorous women in the world of men.
That specific phrase just captures the thematic thread she established, using her talent to subvert her natural advantages and champion the marginalized.
This role earned her a second Academy Award and Golden Globe nomination. And the recognition was just comprehensive.
Miss Magazine honored her with a feature article in the fall of 2005, and she received her star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame that same year. She was officially recognized as an actress whose work carried real social weight.
And what's crucial is that as her artistic profile exploded, so did her control behind the scenes. She launched Denver and Delilah Productions.
Encouraged by her agent, J.J. Harris, who realized that she needed agency to avoid being typecast.
And the production company became her engine for creative control. This allowed her to actively develop and star in projects that interested her, providing her with roles that the conventional studio system might not offer.
Key early produced films included the dramas Sleepwalking in 2008 and The Burning Plain, also in 2008.
The Burning Plain is an interesting example. It had a limited U.S. release, suggesting it was more of an artistic pursuit.
But it performed very successfully internationally.
It did. It demonstrated that her global star power could launch her own content, regardless of the domestic market's interest.
And she balanced that artistic pursuit with a massive commercial endeavor in 2008, the superhero film Hancock.
Starring alongside Will Smith, that film grossed a staggering $624.3 million worldwide.
She had mastered the art of toggling between the $5 million artistic passion project and the $600 million global blockbuster.
But her influence, however, transcended the movie business entirely during this period. In 2008, she was named a UN Messenger of Peace by Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
And he specifically cited her dedication to humanitarian efforts in Africa.
And this led to a wonderful anecdote that reflects her humor and her heritage.
The FIFA World Cup draw.
Yes. Given her global stature, she was invited to co-present the draw for the 2010 FIFA World Cup in Cape Town, South Africa.
And she used that moment to execute this small, highly relevant joke about soccer politics.
Right. Referring to the recent, very controversial Thierry Henry handball incident that led to France qualifying over Ireland.
During rehearsals, she drew an Ireland ball for the global audience.
And the sources indicate that FIFA officials were genuinely alarmed by the stunt. They feared she might repeat the politically charged joke during the live broadcast.
Which just confirms her reputation for sharp wit and a fearlessness in using her platform, even in non-acting diplomatic roles. After that intense period of transformation and global appearances, she took a deliberate 2-year film hiatus. Her return in 2011, however, marked a different kind of transformation.
Leaning into the black comedy genre with Jason Reitman's Young Adult.
Here, she took on a character that was neither action hero nor historical victim, but a deep exploration of arrested development.
A depressed, divorced, alcoholic 37-year-old ghostwriter trying to recapture her high school glory days.
And critics immediately lauded the performance as a new peak of nuance. Richard Roper called it one of the most impressive performances of the year.
And Roger Ebert just simply declared her one of the best actors working today.
It secured another Golden Globe nomination, proving her commercial break hadn't diminished her prestige value at all.
And the following year, 2012, saw her officially transition into a high-end blockbuster villain and supporting player.
Cementing her bankability in CGI-heavy spectacles, she had major roles in two massive productions.
First, she played the evil Queen Ravenna in Snow White and the Huntsman. And the critics knew exactly where the value lay. Mick LaSalle of the San Francisco Chronicle praised her performance as the highlight of an otherwise slow, boring film.
She just stole the show.
And simultaneously, she starred in Ridley Scott's sci-fi epic Prometheus.
Right. And The Hollywood Reporter described her performance there as operating in a cool, detached, ice goddess mode. Perfect for the role all the same.
This period proved she could be the indispensable gravity in enormous, star-studded genre films.
And economically, this was huge. Both Snow White and Prometheus were massive international hits, each grossing around $400 million globally.
This confirmed that her name wasn't just box office for prestige drama, but for event cinema as well.
Her strategic value was recognized across the board. In 2013, Vulture and Y Mag ranked her the 68th most valuable star in Hollywood.
And they specifically argue that any actress who possessed her level of skill, beauty, and ferocity ought to have a permanent place in Hollywood.
The industry recognized that unique blend of attributes she possessed.
But the true definition of her modern stardom came in 2015 with Mad Max: Fury Road.
This wasn't just a role, it was a phenomenon.
It was. She played Imperator Furiosa, effectively making Tom Hardy's titular character a secondary player in his own franchise reboot.
Furiosa became an instant icon. The widespread critical acclaim centered on the dominant nature of her character. She was fierce, capable, complex, and she totally redefined the archetype of the female action hero.
And the film grossed $378.4 million worldwide, just reinforcing her star power.
Richard Roper, recognizing this undeniable shift, declared her officially an A-list action star. based on the strength of Mad Max and her subsequent work in Atomic Blonde.
And she received the Critics' Choice Movie Award for Best Actress in an Action Movie in 2015, confirming her new genre status.
She immediately capitalized on that status by entering one of the largest global franchises, Fast and Furious.
Right. She took on the recurring role of Cypher, the main antagonist and cyber terrorist, starting with The Fate of the Furious in 2017.
Which grossed an astronomical $1.2 billion worldwide.
This demonstrates a brilliant strategic business choice, accepting a lucrative, highly visible recurring franchise role in order to finance and secure distribution for her passion projects.
And she reprised Cypher in F9 in 2021 and Fast X in 2023.
And sandwiched between those massive franchise commitments, she did exactly what she was set up to do. She co-produced and starred in Atomic Blonde in 2017.
This film featured her as a spy operating during the tumultuous collapse of the Berlin Wall. This was a vehicle for her.
A project she controlled, allowing her to shape the action and the character exactly as she saw fit.
And she continued to weave that action with deep drama, reuniting with director Jason Reitman and writer Diablo Cody for Tully in 2018.
Playing an overwhelmed mother of three, a role requiring her to gain substantial weight again, mirroring the full commitment of Monster.
The critics were unanimous in their praise, noting the performance had an admirable deft blend of humor and raw honesty, fueled by her outstanding performance.
It showed that even as an action star, she was still prioritizing the messy, real, non-glamorous human experience.
And her last major prestige role of the decade brought all these threads together, acting, transformation, and production.
In 2019's Bombshell, she co-produced and starred as former Fox News host Megyn Kelly, revolving around the sexual harassment allegations against CEO Roger Ailes.
And the transformation was once again startling, aided by brilliant prosthetics, but ultimately driven by her capacity to capture the internal tension and ambition of the character.
The accolades followed in a flood. Her third Academy Award nomination for Best Actress, plus nominations for the Golden Globe, Critics' Choice, SAG, and BAFTA Awards.
And by this time, her financial status was just impervious. Forbes ranked her the 9th highest paid actress in the world in 2019.
With a reported annual income of $23 million, cementing her legacy as one of the few women in Hollywood who successfully converted acting merit into absolute financial power.
And that success has effortlessly carried into the 2020s. She produced and starred in the Netflix superhero film The Old Guard in 2020.
And she's set to reprise that role in the sequel, The Old Guard 2, in 2025.
Her influence even permeated the highest echelons of modern media mythology, the MCU.
Right. It was revealed in 2022 that she would portray Klee in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, making her debut in the mid-credit scene of Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness.
She also appeared as Lady Lesso in the Netflix fantasy film The School for Good and Evil and had a surprise cameo in the third season opener of The Boys.
And most recently, in 2023, alongside her big-budget commitments, she took on a crucial executive role.
Producing the HBO documentary series Last Call, when a serial killer stalked queer New York.
And this move demonstrates her continued commitment to sensitive, significant nonfiction storytelling, directly linking back to her longstanding activism and focus on marginalized communities.
We've repeatedly mentioned her dual role as star and producer, and it's time to truly dive into the mechanism of that control, Denver and Delilah Productions.
This is more than a side hustle. It is the engine room of her professional agency.
It's crucial to reiterate that she consistently stars in the projects she produces. Look at the list. Monster, Dark Places, Atomic Blonde, Tully, Bombshell.
These are her most critically lauded, often most difficult, transformative roles.
This production company performs a vital dual function. First, it allows her to deliberately select diverse and often challenging roles for herself.
Roles that actively counteract the pressure to simply play the beautiful blonde star.
And second, and maybe more importantly, it allows her to maintain an absolute high level of artistic control over the final product, from casting to the final edit.
It's the difference between being a hired actor and being a true architect of her career narrative.
And if we connect this back to her origin story, growing up in a turbulent environment where she had very little control,
it makes perfect sense that she would prioritize agency above all else in her adult career.
And this drive for agency is paralleled by her profound commitment to global advocacy, starting with the Charlize Theron Africa Outreach Project.
Or CTAEP, which she founded in 2007.
CTAOOB was established specifically to support African youth in the fight against HIV/AIDS.
And this is a complex humanitarian area, and her organization focuses on prevention, education, and community support. By November 2017, the organization had successfully raised over $6.3 million to support local African organizations working on the ground.
Her work earned her high praise from the international community. In 2008, when she was appointed a UN Messenger of Peace by Ban Ki-moon,
the Secretary General's citation was specific. It praised her dedication to improving the lives of women and children and, crucially, preventing violence against women and girls.
And this specific focus, violence against women, is the clearest line drawn from her personal history to her global work.
She is translating her most traumatic personal experience into a framework for global aid and prevention.
Her partnerships are equally strategic. She collaborated with Tom's Shoes in 2009 to create a limited edition vegan shoe,
which resulted in 10,000 pairs being donated to children in need, with proceeds benefiting CTOP.
And later, in 2020, her organization collaborated with Dior Parfums for the Dior Stands With Women initiative,
which leverages her massive endorsement platform to promote assertiveness and achievement for women globally.
Beyond global health, she is a vocal advocate for women's rights in broader political contexts. She has participated in pro-choice rallies.
And in 2015, she signed an open letter to leaders like Angela Merkel and Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, urging that development funding priorities maintain a strong focus on women.
One of the most fascinating details that emerged in the sources regarding her personal advocacy relates to her stance on marriage and equal rights.
Mm-hmm. She publicly stated her refusal to marry her partner until same-sex marriage was legalized nationwide in the U.S.
She articulated this decision so powerfully. She expressed that the institution of marriage felt very one-sided as long as it excluded her gay and lesbian friends who wanted to marry.
For her, it was a fundamental fairness issue.
And she put action behind those words, attending a march and rally supporting gay marriage in Fresno, California in 2009.
And she later emphasized that the government was failing its citizens by not making gay marriage federal, asserting simply that everybody has that right.
This commitment to equality was recognized early on, earning her the GLIAD Vanguard Award back in 2006.
She has consistently used her platform, even at the cost of potential controversy, to advocate for marginalized rights.
Finally, we have to touch on the massive financial engine that is her endorsement life, which is high stakes and sometimes legally complex.
For sure. She was the face of Christian Dior's Giador fragrance, starting in 2004, a role that defined luxury brand advertising for two decades, until she was recently replaced by Rihanna in 2024.
The complexity arose with an earlier endorsement deal. She earned a substantial $3 million for a campaign with Raymond Weil watches between 2005 and 2006.
And Weil subsequently sued her and her production company for breach of contract because she was publicly photographed wearing a competing luxury item, a Dior watch, which she was contractually forbidden from doing.
The lawsuit was eventually settled in 2008.
This incident just underscores the extremely high-stakes nature of modern celebrity endorsements. A $3 million deal can turn into a multi-million dollar lawsuit over a single photograph.
And despite that, she remains a major brand player, joining Brad Pitt, Daniel Wu, and Adam Driver in 2018 as a brand ambassador for Breitling.
So let's shift focus from her business strategy to her artistic process and personal life, starting with her influences. She has cited Susan Sarandon and Sigourney Weaver, both actresses known for their grit and capacity for strong, non-traditional female roles, as major influences on her acting career.
And then there's that wonderfully grounded relationship with Tom Hanks. Mm. She often speaks about how she admired him greatly in her youth, primarily because Hollywood actors were not regularly featured in South African magazines. When she moved to the U.S., she was unaware of the massive level of fame he possessed.
This somewhat naive, down-to-earth starting point is often inferred as a reason for her grounded attitude toward fame and her choice of challenging roles.
She asked for his autograph on her That Thing You Do script, which he had directed, and it was a sweet full-circle moment when she later presented him with the Cecil B. DeMille Award in 2020.
And he confirmed that the admiration was mutual.
When it comes to her method, she emphasizes the need to find a distinct physical identity alongside the emotional truth of a character.
She views preparation like studying, which sounds intellectual, but the practice is highly physical and private.
She finds isolated space where she can sit down, study, and play with the character, a space where she can, in her own words, walk around and be a fucking idiot, and my dogs are the only ones who are seeing that.
That quote just reveals the depth of her commitment to experimentation and the necessary privacy she requires to dismantle and rebuild herself for a role.
And what's remarkable about that physical commitment is the unexpected irony we see in her injury report. She often quips that she gets more serious injuries on sets that are not action films.
Which is almost impossible to believe given the sheer chaos she participates in on screen.
Yet the action roles have certainly delivered their share of damage. While filming the financial misfire Ion Flux, she suffered a serious herniated disc in her neck from a fall.
During a series of back handsprings, yes. It forced her to wear a neck brace for a month. That was career-threatening.
And the more recent action films continued the trend. During The Old Guard, her thumb caught in another actor's jacket during a staged fight, tearing the ligament off the bone.
That wasn't a minor sprain. It necessitated 3 operations and 6 months in a thumb brace, highlighting the long-term cost of her intense dedication to physical realism.
But perhaps the most visceral detail is from the set of Atomic Blonde. She broke several teeth from clenching her jaw so intensely during fighting sequences that she fractured them.
She had to undergo dental surgery to remove the broken teeth, requiring subsequent procedures, including receiving a donor bone and a metal screw. That is dedication taken to a painful extreme.
Okay, now for the non-action oddities. She injured her vocal cords screaming during the intense labor scenes in The Road.
And then there's the psychological cost of transformation. When she gained weight for Tully, consuming processed foods resulted in a depression-like state she described as frightening.
She was in such a panic, fearing she was dying or developing a serious illness, that she called her doctor.
And the doctor's very grounded, succinct response was reportedly, "No, you're 41, calm down."
It was simply her metabolism and hormone levels reacting poorly to the sudden diet change, which just underscores how deeply these physical transformations impact her overall health.
And finally, the truly absurd injuries that happen outside of stunt work.
She laughed so hard while watching the film Borat that her neck locked up for 5 days.
And then, while simply putting on knee pads on the set of the non-action comedy Long Shot, she knocked her head against a bench and ended up in the ER.
She's a magnet for physical chaos, which only emphasizes her underlying resilience.
Moving to her personal and family life, it's worth reiterating the step she took towards cementing her life in the U.S. She became a naturalized U.S. citizen in 2007.
But she made the distinct choice to retain her South African citizenship. She's deeply connected to both countries.
Her long-held interest in adoption, which she harbored since childhood, came to fruition when she adopted a daughter in 2012 and another in 2015.
And in 2019, she spoke publicly about her older daughter, Jackson, who is a transgender girl.
She handled this deeply personal revelation with remarkable clarity and public support, stating that her role was not to decide who her children were, but to support their self-discovery.
They were born who they are. Who they want to be is not for me to decide.
Which reflects the same fierce advocacy for self-determination that characterizes her professional life.
She has been equally candid about her need for professional psychological support, attending therapy in her 30s.
And through that process, she connected her deep-seated anger to the frustrations she felt growing up during South Africa's apartheid, which ended when she was 15.
The historical context and personal trauma were profoundly intertwined.
Regarding relationships, she dated Irish actor Stuart Townsend from 2001 to 2009. She later dated American actor Sean Penn from 2013 to 2015.
But she was quick and firm in strongly denying engagement reports, stating publicly that they merely dated and she was never going to marry him.
Which again reinforces her control over her personal narrative, dismissing media speculation decisively.
And rounding out the conversation about her candid personal life, she appeared on the podcast Call Her Daddy in July 2025 to openly express a newfound love of casual sex, including an encounter with a man 23 years her junior.
She remains someone who is just fearless about discussing her life choices publicly, maintaining agency over her image even in the most private matters.
So what does this all mean? We've looked at a life defined by extraordinary resilience and strategic control. From overcoming the personal trauma of her father's death, surviving poverty on the streets of LA, and then charting a career that actively defies easy categorization.
Excelling in both prestige drama and explosive action filmmaking, she often produces herself.
The key synthesis of her career is this unique duality. She is simultaneously an Academy Award winner, lauded for deep, transformative, unglamorous roles.
Using her body and emotional life as a vessel for characters like Aileen Wuornos and the overwhelmed mother in Tully.
And at the same time, a globally influential action producer and star through Denver and La Jolla, evidenced by the success of Mad Max, Atomic Blonde, and the Fast and Furious franchises.
Her need for agency, born from her turbulent past, led her to produce films early in her career. That decision to prioritize control over immediate fame allowed her to navigate the industry and set the stage for major action franchises and prestige drama simultaneously.
That level of strategic mastery, balancing artistic depth with commercial power, is almost unparalleled in contemporary Hollywood.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you to consider. In an industry that insists on placing talent into neat categories, is she the dramatic transformer or the action star?
Right. Is Charlize Theron's greatest achievement her relentless pursuit of roles that actively confront her own physical beauty and capacity for vulnerability, using art to process personal pain?
Or is her lasting legacy found in her quiet, powerful work in global advocacy, where she translates her intense personal history in South African context into tangible global action through CTO and her UN work?
Which side of her dual life performer versus producer and activist holds the key to her ultimate lasting influence, and which should we remember her for most?
Something to mull over until our next deep dive. Thanks for joining us.
We'll see you soon.